Hi, I'm Rick Steves. From a humble start in the early 1970s along the old hippie trail from Istanbul to Kathmandu, Tony Wheeler and his army of researchers have covered the planet, bringing travelers hundreds of Lonely Planet guidebooks. Lonely Planet is famous for providing information for independent travelers. Their guidebooks gained fame for covering Asia and the developing world. And when they started publishing guidebooks to Europe, Tony and I became competitors. Tony and I each started traveling in similar styles back in the 1970s, so I'm eager to find out, after all those years of dusty backpacks, bouncy rickshaw rides, grotty bathrooms, and airplane turbulence, how he built his company, and what magic does international travel still hold for him today. In the hour ahead, we meet the founder of Lonely Planet and get his take on providing the world with good guidebooks. I'm speaking with Tony Wheeler, the founder of Lonely Planet. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about Tony's new book, Unlikely Destinations, The Lonely Planet Story. Now, let's go back to that early 70s trip then. You did a trip around Europe with Maureen before you did the trip.
Oh, yeah. We knew we traveled well together before we set off on the big one.
Now, way back then, before you could buy a Lonely Planet guidebook, what guidebook did you use?
You know, we did have a sort of guide. It was a thing called the BIT guide.
Yes.
BIT was this London Underground Information Centre. It was a creation of the 60s. And they did all sorts of things. You know, if you were in trouble over drugs or something, you know, or you needed a place to live, you didn't have any money, they'd help you out in these ways. And one of the ways they financed it was by the BIT guides. The BIT guides were these, today it would be a chat room on some website, but back then people sent them postcards and letters, and a guy who later wrote for us assembled them into these mimeographed information sheets. There were three BIT guides. There was the BIT guide to Asia, which was the really good one. There was a pretty reasonable one to Africa, and there was one to South America, which was really pretty hopeless.
Now, the classic one was the Across Asia one, right?
From Across Istanbul. Asia one, yeah.
I used that one in 78. And
yeah.
I think that was sort of the end of the BIT guide time. But
It was definitely grinding to a halt by that time.
In fact,
yeah.
I think it was sort of a ratty old version. It was a couple years old.
Yeah.
But still, you knew who was in prison in Afghanistan and how many blankets they needed. And all these first world guys would help other guys out, and they'd be careful about this at the border. And
it was full of misinformation as well. You know, you knew some people were 8 miles high when they wrote this stuff, but they were great creations, the BIT guides.
Now, that was the old hippie trip from Istanbul to Kathmandu. I measured it by how many border crossings do we have to go, because the border crossings were so stressful.
They were stressful, but they were just amazing. And I think the one from Iran into Afghanistan was the one I remember most clearly.
It's my favorite one. You see all these Volkswagen buses that have been just picked clean.
Yeah.
Just discarded on the side.
You saw all sorts of things. Afghanistan in those days was a wonderful place to go.
I had to wait a whole day until the nurse came to check my shot card or something like that. Remember that?
If you paid some money, you'd have probably got away a day
early. Maybe I should have had a BIT guide for that. But I'll never forget, my friend needed a shot, and there at the border, I remember watching the needle bend as the well-worn needle bend as it tried to go into my friend's arm.
I wouldn't want to think about it.
The old hippie trail to Kathmandu. During those times, it was like magical travel. And so many people, that was the best trip of their life. You write guidebooks for every corner of the world. Is there anything like that today?
There probably is. You know, I'm always amazed how you can get to the most obscure places and you think, you know, well, I'm pretty wonderful being here. This has been quite an achievement to get here. And you turn around and you've got there in a 4x4, and somebody then turns up on a bicycle that they've bought in the bazaar 2 countries down the road. So there is exciting travel still. And, you know, one of the things I really like is just doing very ordinary travel. I did a trip through China about a year and a half ago. I set off from Singapore on my way to Shanghai, and I decided what I would do is I'd just go straight through and never take a flight. I would stick to ground level the whole way. So I went train through Malaysia and buses through Thailand and a little mini truck across into Cambodia and up through Vietnam into China. And I went through China going into towns that were not on any sort of tourist destination at all. They weren't, you know, the Shanghais and Beijings and Xi'ans and so on. They were sort of second-level towns. And that was really interesting because you were seeing places where there weren't any tourists.
You have to go overland. It's so easy to fly from Bangkok to Sri Lanka and have your magic on the beach. But if you actually go overland, now that you mention that, I remember once I decided just to ad lib it from Chiang Mai back to Bangkok and having to go to places that weren't even covered in the guidebooks. and, you know, ad-libbing the transportation. Here's a festival. Let's just drop into the village and what festival's going on. I remember I was shooting a like a little bow and arrow at a target, and I did well, and they cheered, and they brought me condoms. And what's going on? It was a birth control festival for this village to teach them safe sex, you know?
Cabbages and Condoms was the name of a string of restaurants in Thailand at one time.
Is that right? So yeah. I wouldn't have had that had I taken the express train to Chiang Mai and did the standard thing.
Well, there's a lot, you know, traveling around Japan, just getting off the tourist track in Japan, you go to the second string to Shikoku, which, you know, is the fourth biggest island, and no foreign tourists go there at all. You're getting far down the line of things. There's lots of tourists, but only Japanese tourists.
And you meet people who really are curious about you. I remember being naked in a bath with this old man, and he was so angry at America for what we did to the Indians, and he just couldn't get over that. So here I am trying to explain, well, that was a long time ago, and we're trying to clean up our act and all this kind of thing. But you meet people that don't see you as a dollar sign. You're not part of the economy.
Yeah,
and that's critical if you're going to have good travel.
You know, it's unusual seeing that in Japan because you can be quite used to that in the developing world. But in a really advanced country, to be off the beaten track is a whole different perspective. I've done a lot of hitchhiking back in my younger days as well. Both sides of it. I've picked up a lot of hitchhikers over the years as well. But hitchhiking, unfortunately, in most places is not what it once was. New Zealand, Ireland, probably.
Is it the same in the developing world as it was? I mean, of course, you don't hitchhike in Germany now because everybody has a car. But
yeah,
I found in Thailand and Indonesia, anything rolling down the street, if there's room in the back, you can hop in.
Yeah, I think a lot of the developing world, hitching is really just another form of public transport.
Yeah, it's almost a common courtesy to pick somebody up if you're rolling
down. Yeah, you know, any car is a taxi. You know, it's a private car when there's just one person in it. As soon as there's two of you, it's a taxi.
Well, you were just in Iran. Last time I was in Iran, that was the thing. You pointed at the pavement and any car going by would stop, and it was just an ad-lib taxi service.
The last time I was in Iran, which was only a year or two ago, I went out to a restaurant outside of the town I was in, and getting back to the town, there were no taxis around, and I just stuck my thumb out, and the guy picked me up, and this wasn't a taxi thing, you know, he didn't charge me, he was just interested to take me for a ride. And,
well, that's an advantage when you're a first-world traveler in the developing world. People see you as a fascinating conversation.
Mm, absolutely.
I found that in Japan, for sure. People would pick me up all over the place.
Oh, Japan is a wonderful place for independent travel. But, you know, people think there is a language barrier, but there's also this overwhelming politeness and responsibility to make sure you don't get too lost.
Well, there's the overwhelming confusion, at least on my part.
It's overwhelming confusion as well, yeah.
And then the overwhelming politeness.
Yeah.
And then the language barrier. And what do you get? Travel fun.
Oh, you sure do, yeah.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. And today we're traveling all over the place because we're talking with Tony Wheeler. And Tony is the founder of Lonely Planet Publications. There are guidebooks literally to every country on this planet. Tony publishes, I think, 400 different destination titles and 600 books in all at Lonely Planet. And Tony is talking up his newest book, Unlikely Destinations, The Lonely Planet Story. Tony, when you think of the magic of travel, and you and I have been at it for 30-some years these days, are people backpacking today? Is there the same kind of backpacking magic today, the essence of good travel?
I think today one of the interesting things about travel is it has sort of splintered into all sorts of different directions. There are all sorts of different travel. And yeah, there are people still backpacking. You know, I live in Australia, and when I first went to Australia 30-some years ago, tourists were very few and far between. There were the occasional wealthy tourists, you know, who were going everywhere, and they went to Australia as well. And the backpackers you met at that time were very intrepid. It was very unusual just to meet a backpacker traveling around Australia. Although the facilities were there, there were lots of Australians traveling around. Mm-hmm. And if they were staying in campsites or hostels, well, you know, so could a visitor from overseas.
Do you have a lot of pressure as a publisher trying to sell books to cater to more affluent travelers?
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite happy to cater for more affluent travelers. I mean, I've done some affluent travel trips in recent years because there's some things, you know, if you want to go down to Antarctica, and I've been to Antarctica twice, it's going to be fairly expensive. Mm-hmm. It's not a cheap trip. You know, if you go down on an Antarctic ship, the sort of ships that go down there, the good ones are really quite small. They're only 30 or 40 passengers. And that's not going to be like a big cruise ship, but it's going to be as expensive as a big cruise ship.
Right, oh, sure. Right.
But you know, it's a great trip, and the people who are going down there are really interested in travel.
Let's talk about the very beginning of Lonely Planet. Back in the 70s, to me, there was a community of travelers, and I remember being on that trail going from Istanbul over to Kathmandu. There was a community on the bus that I was on, travelers from all over the world, and there was a hunger for information. We were all scavenging around. What book do you have? What do you have? Do you have this? And I would spend afternoons just borrowing books from other people. Of course, we had that bit guide you were talking about. Is there a moment in your travels that you realized, man, there is a need for this kind of information? Somebody's got to do it right.
Yeah, we decided in 1973, when we were living in Sydney in Australia, that we should put our trip down and make it into a book. It actually developed bit by bit, that people... Bit by bit, yes, oh, yeah. Like just like the bit guides. Now, people would ask us, you know, and we'd sort of scribble some notes down, and they'd say, well, you know, which places should I go in India? And we'd sort of list it, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 to 10. Or, you know, which of the borders are difficult? And we ended up thinking, we're doing so much of this. Why don't we put it down in book form? So the book developed almost by accident that way. But I think it was an era that when that was happening, because Moon Publications, Bill Dalton, started just around the same time. He actually did his first book just a few weeks before us. And he was actually, even though he was American, he was actually in Australia at the same time.
I was just thinking about that. My favorite travel guidebook writers, publishers, all started this way. I mean, Arthur Frommer, of course, started that way.
Yeah.
As a GI in Germany.
And Arthur's a, you know, he's an elderly gentleman now, but, you know, what he did was really pioneering. I've got a huge amount of respect for Arthur Frommer.
Oh, yeah. And he just realized that there's people that want to understand the world and we can share information.
Yeah, and, you know, the real thing that Arthur did was he realized that guidebooks didn't have to be just the history, the culture, how big the church is, how many pictures there are in the gallery, that the getting there and the where to stay and the good restaurants to eat in were just as much a part of the tourist experience.
Well, and if you read any sort of statistics, you know, people travel to eat, so you better have some restaurants in your guidebook.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, you started the Lonely Planet series. At that time, I believe there were the Frommer, Fodor, Birnbaum, and Fielding books out.
Yeah, and the Blue Guides in Europe. Guides. There were a few things.
How was Lonely Planet different?
Well, I think
because you're huge now, and I would say
bigger than most. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the difference initially was that we were just doing places that other people weren't doing. You know, we were looking for the little niches, the places that the big guys who we sort of perceived as being in New York and London, they weren't doing those places. So we did that. But I think also we did bring a different perspective to them. We were a little bit, I guess, we're younger. We were hipper. We were looking at things in a slightly more offhand manner in a way. Although we always had, I think we always had a great respect for the cultures and the places we went into. We were fascinated by them. But we were a little bit more nonchalant about things. And that I think that flavor came over in the books, that we were enjoying ourselves.
Well, it's a backpacker heritage, I think.
Yeah, I think it is.
You got backpacker roots.
Yeah. I'm fine with it, because I think backpackers, the money they spend goes in at ground level. It goes straight into local people's pockets. They're pioneers in many ways. They open the doors to other things. And the other thing, of course, from the business perspective, and this book is a little bit of business as well, is you want young people buying your books. You want young people joining you, because they're going to stick with you. You know, old fogies like me, we're not going to be around forever. But the 18-year-old doing that first trip, they've got a lot of traveling ahead of them.
Yeah, it's the gateway. This is their first trip. If it's a good one, there's going to be a lot of them. If it's not a good one, they're going to just buy a fancier car next year instead.
Absolutely. And another thing, of course, is that a young person who's got themselves the other side of the world and is traveling somewhere, they've got a lot more get up and go than someone of the same age who's sitting at home watching it on television.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves, and I'm joined by Tony Wheeler. Tony is the founder of Lonely Planet Publications. It's the biggest travel publisher on the planet right now, with guidebooks to literally every country on the planet. And Tony is talking about his new book. It's Unlikely Destinations, and it's the story of Lonely Planet. Tony, you got 400 books now. It started back in the early 70s as a pile of notes. Tell me the evolution of the company from the start.
Well, the first book we did was an accident. We didn't set out and have the intention of doing a guidebook at the end of it. We traveled across Asia. We spent 6 months. It was a wonderful trip. And at the end, we thought somebody should do a book about this. So our first guide was a guide to the Asia Overland Trip, the Hippie Trail, as people later on called it. That book hasn't survived, because the Asia Overland Trip effectively died. Iran, Afghanistan, they more or less killed that book. But the second book we did, Southeast Asia on a Shoestring, is still around now, 13 editions later. People started calling it the Yellow Bible, because the first edition had a yellow cover. It sold over 1 million copies. It's, you know, a book that a lot of people have a strong connection with. That was 1975 we put that second book out. We traveled 74, published it 75. But the big jump forward after that was doing a guide to India, which came out in 81. We researched it in 1980. Mm-hmm. And that was it was a big book. It was twice as big as anything we published previously. It was a book that there was a big pent-up demand for, that there were a lot of people going to India, and it was a country that people had a fascination for. Nobody goes to India and comes away unaffected. You don't go there lightly. You don't think, I'm just going to go there and lie on the beach or hit a few restaurants. You go to India because you've got a real interest in the place, and you really want to see it and understand it. So from a guidebook publisher's point of view, India is just perfect territory.
When people ask me what my favorite country is, I kind of surprise them and say India. It really is. When you've been to India, there's something just incredible about it.
Yeah, it's like that old story, you know, that you know, when you tire of life, London, you tire of life. Right. India too.
India and India rearranges all your furniture. We're so Americans, especially, I think, have so many truths that we find self-evident and God-given. And you go to India and you realize, oh, I'm not so self-assured anymore. Across the board, things are different in India. I remember being there in '84, and that's when your book had really taken off. And I was just a self-published author there, and I had a handful of copies of a single title out, I think. And I saw the penetration you had. Every traveler had the Lonely Planet India guidebook, even if they didn't speak English. That was it.
Look, I've loved seeing our India book being used by Indians.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing better than going to India and going to some historic site and seeing two Indian people, you know, the woman in a sari going by and looking at your book, you know, and reading about it.
It's my favorite compliment if a local person uses one of my guidebooks.
Yeah, you know? It is fantastic. It really makes you feel good.
And by the way, reading Unlikely Destinations, the Lonely Planet story, it was just engrossing for me anyways, because I'm in the
same
business.
Thing. Yeah.
And I just, the challenges you had to get this off the ground, and the challenges I think you must have had in delegating the writing and finding good people to run, because you couldn't do it all yourself. So you found some key people that really helped things take off. Tell me about that.
Fairly early on, we realized, you know, we couldn't do everything ourselves. If we were going to be a real publishing house, it required more people working with us, more people researching the books. And one of the people who joined us really early on, and I think in the early years of the business, he had played a major part of it, was a guy called Jeff Crowther. And he was a real product of the 60s hippie sort of thing. He'd lived in London. He'd worked on those bit guides. He'd gone back and forth. He'd been in India for a year. You know, he'd traveled very widely. He'd got every disease from malaria to hepatitis you could pick up along the way. He traveled hard as well. And he just had a real interest in the places. He could name every ruler of every country in Africa, and he knew the history. And he was a very interesting guy, a very hard-working guy, and a very hard-living guy as well.
This is before you could email home your work. Did he ever lose his notes?
I don't think Jeff ever did. You know, Jeff would come through and...
Because you got some great stories in your book about writers that got into all sorts of accidents and hardships, they hung onto their notes.
I've had stories from my writers, you know, the boat's sinking and the last thing they want to let go of is the notes. I've also heard some sad stories. Not a guy who wrote for us, but a German friend who was right at the very end of a very long trip researching a book. Had a bag stolen out of a car while he was there. Somebody's hand came in through the window and grabbed the bag that all his notes were in. And I think, oh, what a heartbreak.
In your book, there's an interesting quote. It says, Lonely Planet is a small company dedicated to publishing books about country nobody ever visited. What was the context of that? Do you remember?
You know, I can't remember which one, but we have done that. And I'm always proud when we do that. Because I think, you know...
It's part of your philosophy, isn't it?
Then? Yeah. I mean, I love the civilized travel. You know, I'm just as happy at, you know, nice restaurants in Provence and pretty guest houses and great pastas in Italy. And I like that stuff as well as you do, Rick. I mean, I know why it's so good. I've done a lot of it and I enjoy it. But I also like the edgy places. I mean, you'd say you like India and I can understand why.
Sure.
The edgy places are fun. And that there is a real kick out of doing a guidebook that you know nobody else is doing. You know, I really like the fact that if you want a Mongolia guide, come and talk to us. Or if you want an Iran guide, come and talk to us.
Doesn't Hilary Bratt do guidebooks that are more obscure than yours?
Hilary does. I mean, I've got to say that I respect Hilary enormously. Because,
she makes you look so mainstream.
Well, Hilary is the definition of an eccentric English woman, and she is terrific. I mean, she's a hard traveler as well.
Oh, yeah.
I tell a Hilary Bratt story. I went with a bunch of travel writers and travel publishers, and Hilary. We all were staying in the same little Black Forest hotel in Germany once after the Frankfurt Book Fair. And we went out walking one day, and we brought back an amazing assortment of mushrooms, which we just gave to the chef at the restaurant and said, mushroom pasta tonight. He was very concerned about this, but Hilary knew exactly which ones were safe to eat and which ones weren't. And she went through them with the chef. There were a couple that he just didn't want to cook them because he was, you know, afraid he was going to kill us. And she eventually said, okay, we'll leave those couple out. But that one, even though you're a bit uncertain, I am positive it's okay. Hilary knows her mushrooms as well.
She knows her mushrooms.
Yeah.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Tony Wheeler, and Tony is the founder of Lonely Planet, and he's written a book that tells the story, Unlikely Destinations, The Lonely Planet Story. Tony, my books are with no apologies for American travelers, and that's my market, and that's who I write to. Now, you write books that are coming from Australia, and that's a pretty small market, so you got to open it up. Do you have to make any compromises to fill the needs of Brits as well as Americans, or how do you handle that?
A little bit. You know, we want fresh language. We want the things to be, you know, interesting to read and, you know, not be stuffy. But at the same time, we're very aware that a lot of different people are using our books. And I always say try and avoid expressions that in the English language really relate only to one country. You know, and there are lots of words that only Americans use or only the British use or only Australians use. And you've really got to
Or that
avoid.
Can be really rude in one country and not in another.
Absolutely. There's some famous mistakes. I mean, the perfect one, of course, is the British use of a rubber, which is a pencil eraser in Britain and is a condom in America.
That's right.
You know, so there are those sort of words, you know, that you can, two, what did they say? Two people divided by a common language. But also, we know a lot of people of whom English is not their first language use our books. Because if you're a Frenchman and you're going to Samoa or Tonga in the Pacific, there is not going to be a guide in French. You're probably going to have to use our book.
Wouldn't Norwegians, for instance, if they travel?
Norwegians, there's no books.
There's 4 million Norwegians. What are they going to?
They're going to buy our books in English. I mean, we have a big market in countries like Norway or the Netherlands or Sweden, where our books are the only option. But equally, you have a big market in countries like Germany or France or Italy, where there are lots of books in the local language. The obscure places, they're going to have to read them in English.
You have to have a style, an editing style that's
straightforward. Takes the point.
Yeah. Now, you're a powerful publisher and you're a political person. Do you have a political agenda in your work?
Yeah. I mean, I think that when you go to a country, the politics is important as well. And we were saying earlier that, you know, food is just as important as how good the museum is. You may enjoy the museum all day, but if you don't get a good meal at night, you know, it's not going to be a great experience. So these things are all factors in the travel experience.
As are the politics.
As are the politics,
I was just in Mostar. Where they...
They've had a war.
Had a war.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's...
What was it about?
Grandmothers were raped in the mosque.
Yeah.
And then the other grandmothers were raped in the church. And now you've got all of these minarets and steeples sticking up and you've
and
got
build, a new, they're busy building bigger ones. Yeah.
And you've got a rebuilt bridge that was the symbol of the city.
Yeah. And it looks good too, doesn't it?
It's great. And to go there and to not have an appreciation or an interest in the politics... And,
you're not
and
going to understand. You know,
it's ridiculous. Yeah.
You see that bridge, you know, and they did a really good job of rebuilding it.
Yeah.
But the rebuilding it was a symbol that, you know, this... disaster was being healed in some way. But if you didn't know that it had been destroyed, you wouldn't, you know, appreciate the fact that it's been rebuilt. You've got to have that politics.
How has travel shaped your politics?
It's funny. I think, you know, they say that as you get older, you go more and more to the right. And I find it maybe I'm going more and more to the left. There are terrible inequalities in our world. And I'm uncomfortable with a lot of the... We are so wealthy in the West these days. You know, we all have so much. And I've got so much. I mean, I know I'm so well off, and yet I don't like to see it flaunted the way it is sometimes.
Do you feel like the work that you do can prepare a traveler to have a beneficial impact on his outlook through his travel?
I sometimes say with our books that the guidebooks have to do a number of things. They have to be just straightforward guidebooks. You arrive at some place you've never been to before. You come out of the train station. The guidebook has to say, turn right, you will get mugged. Turn left, there's some really nice guest houses. You know, that sort of very straightforward life-saving information almost, it needs to be there. But equally, the guidebook needs to inform you, make you a better traveler, help you not
prime
to
prime somebody to have a valuable experience as well as an efficient and budget and safe experience.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, not to make the stupid gaffes that you can make if you don't understand a little bit about the culture. But equally, understand it a bit better. If you go there and you know a little bit about their religion, you're going to appreciate the church or the mosque or the temple a lot more than if you go there and it's just a weird building.
I traveled from Istanbul to Kathmandu with a guy who just got a degree in comparative religion studies at Stanford. I didn't realize it until I got halfway through Afghanistan, but it's nice to have somebody with you who knows about the different religions.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they really do open doors to you. But even I remember traveling around India with our kids when they were quite small. We made a game of the temples. There's a Ganesh temple. How do you know it's the god Ganesh? Because there's the elephant-headed figure. And that little rat that you see outside, the stone rat, that's the god's vehicle, because every Hindu god has a vehicle, and an animal that supposedly transports that god. Well, for the kids, this became a game. And, you know, after a week in India, the Shiva temple, a Vishnu temple, something, you know, which... You'd think you'd have to be some sort of scholar of Hinduism to understand.
Your kids are in their 20s now, and they've traveled every year somewhere. What are they doing these days?
Both of them work for Lonely Planet. My son is a computer technician. My daughter is a commissioning editor.
All right.
So both of them are involved in the, family business.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. Today I'm joined by Tony Wheeler. Tony Wheeler is the founder of Lonely Planet Publications, the biggest travel publisher on the planet. Lonely Planet has guidebooks to literally every country in the world. Can you say that?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Maybe 99% of the countries on the planet. And he's written a new book telling the story of his work called Unlikely Destinations, The Lonely Planet Story. And I tell you, it was a very interesting read. That might be partly because you're my competitor. But I just
We've had similar experiences, Rick.
We really have. And we talk about that. And when you think of all the travel writers that are really busy today, we all started, I mean, the guys whose names you know, started in the 70s as guys running around learning that, hey, information's important if you're going to be traveling.
Information's important. The other thing that intrigues me, it's all travelers becoming publishers rather than publishers thinking we should do travel.
Well, the successful ones.
Yeah.
I think that's a compliment to our buying public.
Yeah, it is. They recognize what it's about.
I think it's a grassroots kind of thing, and it's great to talk to you. When you publish guidebooks, you have to be concerned about delicate politics, frankly. You got a situation like Burma where there's serious human rights abuses and you're writing a guidebook telling people to go there. How do you handle that?
Well, we don't tell people to go there. We give them the information. It's up to them. And with that book specifically, we very much underline why you shouldn't go there. And if you decide that you don't want to go there because you feel it's wrong, well, then I can see why you might feel that. My feeling is, and I've got a lot of friends in Burma, people who basically are involved in some way or other in tourism. And, you know, if tourists stop going, their living, their everyday existence is cut out from underneath them. So from that point of view, I think that tourists should go there. And I've, you know, there are people who've worked with Aung San Suu Kyi and the elected should-be government of the country. So they're not coming at it from the military dictatorship's perspective. But I think that's a situation with many countries. You have to think about the ups and downs of visiting them, the good points and the bad points about it.
I went to a conference once called Tourism, a Vital Force for Peace. And I just really believe fundamental to all of this stuff is the more people can understand each other by meeting each other one-on-one, it's got to be a good thing.
In both directions, us visiting them and them meeting us when we go there.
Is it Myanmar or Burma?
It depends what you want to call it.
So why did you call it Burma instead of Myanmar?
Well, we called it both. We call it in our book these days. I think we say Myanmar because that is officially the name of the country. Yeah. You know, that may have had a different name at one point, but as far as the United Nations are concerned and as far as the passports and the stamp on your passport are concerned, it's Myanmar.
So you got to deal with this a lot, don't you?
You do, yeah. And there is a quite legitimate argument for why it should not be called Burma, and that is that the Burmese are only one of the people of Burma, that they're the majority people, but Myanmar is a country which incorporates the Burmese people and many other people as well. Now, there are people who oppose tourism to Burma and oppose the government. Basically, they oppose anything the government does. So the fact the government has called it Myanmar is opposed as well, which, you know, I can understand that too.
Well, you write guidebooks, and when you travel around, there's a body of water called the Persian Gulf, isn't there?
Well, there's a body of water called the Persian Gulf from the Iranian side of the Gulf, from the other side of the Gulf, the Arabian Gulf, and there's also a body of water to the north of Japan called the Sea of Japan. But as far as the Koreans are concerned, it's to the east of Korea, and it is the East Sea.
So does your Japan guidebook actually call it the Sea of Japan, and your Korean guidebook call it the East Sea?
And it causes us a huge amount of trouble with the Japanese government. We do that.
You let that trump the concerns?
Yeah, because, you know, in Korea, no Korean wants to go down and dip their feet when they go to the beach in the Sea of Japan.
Right.
You know, Japan was the country that occupied them, that treated them terribly.
Sure.
They don't want to go to the Sea of Japan. We have had a lot of trouble. We've had a delegation from the Japanese government come around to our office and present in great detail the information informing us that we are incorrect and we should fix this problem, please.
And just from a simple marketing point of view, I mean, I've got a book called The Best of Eastern Europe, and people who live there don't consider themselves Eastern Europeans.
They don't like it at all.
And no, but if I call it Central Europe, my buying public wouldn't know what it covers.
Yeah, and we've got that problem right now with a book that we title with a lot of asterisks to it, Western Balkans. It incorporates the Balkans, but it also incorporates Albania, and it also incorporates Slovenia. And Slovenia is not part of the Balkans at all.
So the Slovenes probably aren't.
The Slovenes are not happy about it at all. But what are we going to call it? Are we going to call it the Western Balkans plus Albania and also Slovenia?
Croatia and friends.
Croatia and friends, or Croatia and friends and people we weren't friends with at one time, ex-Yugoslavia and also. Oh, it's hopeless.
Bill Dalton wrote a guidebook to Indonesia. It was the classic, it was the dominant,
Indonesia
the
handbook,
best guidebook, the Indonesian handbook. And for a while, I understand, it was outlawed, I guess, technically by their government, not available for sale in the country.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever had problems like that with your books that have been so, not that you've been wrong politically, but the government just didn't want you to tell what was going on and they wouldn't let your book in?
Yeah, there's a sort of defining line, you know, whether you can't sell the book in that country. And that certainly happened with Bill's Indonesia book. It couldn't be sold in Indonesia. But it wasn't actually confiscated when you arrived.
Have you ever had that problem?
We have. We've had it severely in one or two countries in Africa. Once upon a time, Malawi, we weren't very complimentary to, I think it was Hastings Banda, who was president for life, and our Malawi book. And I've
president for life.
Kim Il Sung in North Korea is the president beyond life. Oh, he's still officially the president even now.
Political correctness must be an interesting thing. I get a lot of people telling me I can't talk about bullfights because we don't want to promote that and so on. And, you know, I just feel like I'm not here to make a judgment. This is a reality. It happens. I'm not saying do it. I'm not saying don't. How do you handle that in your...
I the same thing. I mean, bullfights, I've never been to I've been to some of those mock bullfights they hold in Provence, but I've never been to a real bullfight, and I don't particularly think I'd want to, but it is part of Spanish culture. Even if it is a declining part these days, I guess. And it seems to me if someone going there wants to do it, if they that's their decision. If they want to go and see that, that's their decision. And I think then it's the guidebook writer's duty to tell them how much the tickets cost and, you know, which is the sunny side of the stadium you don't want to be
without letting
his
personal
down.
Feelings get in the way of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the start, it's right up to him to say, this is the history of it. This is the book that Hemingway wrote about it. This is why the Spanish love it. Right. And here is the counter-argument that it's a very cruel sport. It's
you
killing
can lay
animals.
Out both sides.
Yeah.
Now, in my writing, I have to admit, I've got a few personal things that I'm passionate about, and I'd be sure to talk about them. And I take that little guilty pleasure in injecting that into my books. I'm really into traffic-free zones.
Good,
I'm really into alternatives to the American war on drugs, smarter drug policy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really into longer vacations.
Yes,
and when I get
I
a chance, I talk about how great the French are at creating the vacation and this sort of thing. Do you have any little guilty pleasures that way that you sneak into your publications?
Yeah, I guess so. I hadn't really thought of it in that respect. I mean, I can be a hedonist at times. I mean, my trouble, really, Maury, my wife is always telling me, is I have a very short attention span, and that a lot of things that people really like, you know, lots of, I get tired of very quickly. I love going to beaches, but after I've been on the beach for half an hour, I've sort of seen it, and I'm getting sand in my novel, and I'd rather be sitting in a more comfortable chair to be reading it. I do have guilty pleasures. Yeah, I'm someone who likes that drink at sunset. And there are some places in the world, you know, Mexico always struck me as one of the most civilized places to go for an evening sundown. And there'd be some very nice looking square and there'd be tables out around the square and the sun would be going down. And that's really the time for a ice cold cerveza.
Have you ever picked up a fungus going barefoot into a shower?
I've had tropical ulcers. You know, you cut yourself and it doesn't heal up. And eventually... You go and get a shot of penicillin, and that seems to cure it. I've had a few things go wrong.
Do you go barefoot in showers?
Yeah, I do.
People say, I wouldn't step into a shower. You'll pick something up. I've spent 120 days a year for 25 years walking into strange showers.
And, you know, I clean my teeth with whatever water comes out of the taps. And I'm reasonably careful about the drinking water in places, but the idea of cleaning your teeth with mineral water all the time, forget it.
What's the last thing you stole from a hotel?
Do you know, I've almost got in the habit of doing the opposite, that I really don't like this, you know, constantly opening little shampoo bottles and taking a quarter inch out of the top. And I tend to pick up one in one hotel and use it for a week and then, you know, leave the Sheratons at the Hilton, but, you know, leave a shampoo bottle somewhere further down the line.
I have the same exact ethic.
Do you?
They're called the Itsy Bitsies, and I never use those things. I put out my own bar of soap and my own, I've got a little bottle of shampoo that lasts me 3 weeks.
Yeah, it does last a long time.
And in these hotels, if I open up a soap, I want to use it tomorrow. They throw it away. They make me open a new one up.
I know. Hotels that do that, not all hotels do it, but occasionally you do find that. You know, and if they're going to do that, you know, then I just hide the soap away and put it out again.
Yeah.
God, aren't we frugal? This is appalling.
I used to have a thing in my book that says, you hang this piece of paper up, it says, don't wash my towels unless I put them on the floor.
Now they all do, of course.
but they've stopped doing that now. So I need to resurrect that whole notion because they still insist on washing every day. Tony Wheeler, when you cross a border and they say, what's your occupation? What do you say?
I say publisher usually, not a writer. Do not be a writer or a journalist. Even journalists is even worse than writers. In fact, one of the worst places now to be a journalist as a foreign traveler is, guess where? The United States.
I've heard.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because for most Western countries, the visa waiver system means as a visitor, whether it's on business or as a tourist, you don't need a visa. If you're an Australian, a British, a New Zealander, a French, a Japanese, unless you're a journalist. When this first came in, a lot of journalists didn't realize and just turned up here on quite innocuous things. One guy was an Australian rock music journalist who'd come to interview Madonna and was arrested and handcuffed and sent back to Australia. This is not a good way to attract tourists.
As a publisher, you have to deal with all of these temptations for travelers, black market things. You used to be able to buy something and sell it at a border to make money. All of this sort of street smarts for travel.
Yeah,
is that still an issue?
There's a certain amount of it. One of the things we're very, very positive about warning about, there's lots of places in the world where messing with drugs is complete madness.
It's just flat out stupid.
It's flat out stupid. You know, if you want to end up in jail, you're much more comfortable ending up in jail in the United States than
rather than Turkey
or doing it in Singapore where you're going to be hung for it.
Right.
You know, and I totally disagree. I don't think people should be hung for drugs.
Right.
I mean, I don't think people should be hung for murder even, but for drugs even more so.
Well, as a guidebook publisher, I would suppose that when it's a moral obligation to tell people
to warn people, yeah. I mean, but people continue to be stupid. But as far as the buying things and selling things go, look, there are lots of little tricks that people learn.
People used to fund their travels in perpetuity just by knowing what to buy and sell at borders.
Well, the Poles were wonderful at it. I mean, when young Polish people started traveling before the wall fell down and, you know, Poland became part of the Western world, the Poles were amazing buyers and sellers. And I've got Polish friends, you know, who the buying carpets in India and selling them in Singapore and then buying the watches in Singapore and selling those in India and then going somewhere else. It was phenomenal how they did this.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm joined by Tony Wheeler, founder of Lonely Planet Publications. We're talking about his new book, Unlikely Destinations, The Story of Lonely Planet. To me, travel has a spiritual dimension.
I think it does. I think there are places you go there, and it can be something that has no religion in it at all. You realize what a wonderful world we live in. It looks so good. And that can be a natural thing. I love walking in Nepal. The Himalayas, you know, are fantastic. I've had so many mornings where you wake up in the morning and you open your tent and you look out there, and there's some mountain there, you know, one of the highest mountains in the world. And it just takes your breath away. And, you know, you feel privileged to be alive. It is such a feeling. But equally, you know, there are man-made things as well. And it can be something like the rice fields in Bali or the Philippines, where these little rice fields trip up the hills and they are just so beautiful. You realize why it's inspired artists in those countries to paint them. Or towns in Italy. You look at it and you think that this was
done to the glory of God by hardworking people 500 years ago.
Well, it was. And it was under the glory of postcard makers today. You know?
Right. Yeah.
It's like they took the postcard and thought, that's a wonderful postcard. I'll build a town that looks like it.
I always think the greatest cathedral in Europe is the top of the Alps. You know, I mean, it's just incredible.
Yeah.
And you can get that in the Himalayas, too. Boy, when you're traveling, though, whether you're a religious person or not, you encounter religion, and it just permeates most societies you travel in.
Yeah, one of the nicest religious experiences I've had recently was in Iran, where I was walking around the main square in Isfahan, and a carpet salesman came out and tried to sell me a carpet and then just wanted to practice his English. And when we got down towards the big mosque that's at the end of the square in Isfahan, he asked if I'd been to it, and I said, yeah, I've been in earlier in the day. And he said, well, you should go in again now because it's night. And you get in free at night when tourists get charged in the daytime. But he said it looks quite different at night. And when we got to the mosque, it was prayer time and the guard there wouldn't let me in. And my carpet salesman guide immediately started arguing with this guy. And after a few minutes, and other people joined in the argument as well, the guard said, look, they all say you should go in. And really, I agree. And he said, if you go in and keep to one side and keep quiet, you won't disturb the people who are praying. And we all think you should go and see it. And I thought, look, here I am in a strictly Islamic country. It's an Ayatollah who rules it effectively. And yet they're so proud of their religion and their mosque. They're inviting me, they're insisting that as a non-believer, I should go in and see it. And that's not the impression we get of these Islamic countries.
When you travel, it breaks that down and you see the fundamental deep down inside of religion to be a peaceful and beautiful thing.
Mm.
And you can recognize how it's mucked up by a lot of
people. It is mucked up by a lot of people, unfortunately. And it's... You know, the other thing that I enjoyed in Iran was there's a lot of joking about the religion. It's a great film if people
there's
like
joking Iran. About the religion in Iran.
Oh, absolutely.
You're kidding. I didn't think there was any sense of humor in
Iran. No, there's a huge sense of humor in Iran.
Tell me more.
Well, I just recently saw a woman, an Iranian comedian. She was actually telling me a joke about arriving in America and someone looking at her passport and saying, you're from Iran, which really annoys the Iranians calling it Iran. And she said, yes, there I was at iMigration in America.
That'll do it. Tony, do you struggle with the morality of pushing travel when everybody is realizing travel contributes to global warming?
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly in the UK, which seems to be worrying about it more than some other places, the word travel guilt is becoming part of the vocabulary. And every article about a travel trip in a travel magazine or a newspaper in Britain is always followed at the end, it seems, with a how much you need to contribute to some sort of carbon matching thing to balance the damage that your trip is doing. So it is becoming a major element. And what particularly worries me is the almost frivolous nature of some of the travel. I think it's one thing to go off on some trip and go here and go there and see this and do that and contribute to the economy in this way or contribute it in that way. But to rush off to some place for a party weekend and spend the whole weekend just getting drunk and not even stay in a hotel and, you know, get on the plane and fly back to... And this is from Britain in particular again, because they're the ones talking about it.
For people who aren't aware of this, yeah, this is a new kind of travel phenomenon. Hen parties and stag parties where all a bunch of gang of friends will get together to celebrate before a wedding and they will fly on a dirt cheap flight from London to, what, Prague and Berlin and...
Tallinn has become a party town.
It's changing the landscape of these towns because they're inundated with these low-end travelers that are just going there for the cheap drinks and to be out late at night. They don't even have a hotel and they fly home.
Yeah. And the carbon emissions to pay for that trip to the bar is just ridiculous.
I think Europeans are going to be more inclined to accept and get to the point where they pay carbon taxes to be as much as they can be carbon neutral in things
but
like
but is
this.
That an answer, Rick? I mean,
I don't know.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't think it really is. I mean, it's putting a Band-Aid on the scratch when really we shouldn't have scratched it in the first place.
Yeah, well, this is something we'll be dealing with. 10 years from now, will travelers be holding a paper guidebook?
Who knows? Today I say that the guidebook is not going to die. We're going to keep researching guidebooks, but whether the guidebook will be on paper is a different thing. And I think the guidebook could eventually be something, it'll be like a combination of some sort of PlayStation thing and a small computer and a GPS and a cell phone, and we'll weld all this together. And not only will the guidebook tell you what a really good restaurant is, but it'll point an arrow in which direction you should start walking. And at the same time, it'll say, press here to make a reservation.
I would imagine the fundamental value of the information and the fundamental beauty of travel will be exactly the same, though.
Yeah, that won't change. That won't change.
Tony Wheeler, founder of Lonely Planet Publications, author of Unlikely Destinations, The Lonely Planet Story. Tony, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for visiting us.
Great talking to you too, Rick.
Happy travels.
Thank you.
Rick Steves teaches smart European travel. At ricksteves.com, you'll find an archive of interviews from his radio show, free audio tours of Europe's top sites, a monthly newsletter, and a world of information to help you turn your European travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality. To gear up for your next European adventure, begin your trip at ricksteves.com.